What a busy quarter one of 2024 that just was for digital assets. Today, I'll be sitting down with Blake Hyman, who's a senior associate in WisdomTree's quantitative research team. We're going to think about the next 6 months. What lies in store for digital assets? That's the big question after what was already a big start to the year. We're going to talk about ETFs, naturally. We're going to talk about Bitcoin halving, it's coming. And we're going to talk about changes in the technology stack, which you know I love talking about. Welcome back to Crypto Clarified. This is the podcast where we think about the opportunities and risks posed by an ever-evolving digital asset ecosystem. My name is Benjamin Dean, and I am a director in WisdomTree's digital assets team. People in the US, listen. WisdomTreePrime.com. You can go on the Apple or Android app stores. You can find it. Go and have a look. Hit subscribe for this podcast. If you're on Spotify, subscribe. If you're on YouTube, subscribe. If you're on the Apple podcast site, subscribe and share with your friends. Sharing is caring. You can find me on the Bird app, X at Benjamin Dean. Before we begin, Sam and James in compliance. This disclaimer is for you and listeners. You know, I have to do this because if you've ever seen Silence of the Lambs, you know what happens if you don't do the disclaimer correctly. To clarify, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of WisdomTree and are subject to change. Anything we present in this podcast is not intended to be relied upon as a forecast, research, nor as investment or tax advice. The information and opinions expressed in this podcast are not a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any securities, and reliance upon them is at the sole discretion of the listener. Please remember, past performance is no indication of future results. All right, on to the fun stuff. Hey, we recorded this the other day, doing it on the fly. My apologies if the audio quality isn't up to that which we would usually have, but I tell you, Blake is super interesting. His outlook for the next 6 months is worth listening to. I'm sure you'll love it. Let's move on and cut to Blake.
Blake, welcome back.
Thanks, Ben. Appreciate you having me here.
It's always a pleasure to have you on. And I know we have a lot of ground to cover today because you've just put your outlook out for the coming 6 months. I had a look through it. Lots of interesting stuff in there and plenty to unpack for the listeners. If you were to give it a summary in a few sentences, what is your outlook? Do you think the space is going to grow? Do you think it's a bright outlook? Are there risks on the horizon? What are the things you have your eye on at a high level?
Yeah, I would say it's definitely optimistic and definitely, you know, the space continues to grow. We're witnessing that right now. So the outlook remains consistent there for what we're seeing, which is positive growth. There's always risks involved here. So I think that's, you know, kind of inherent with this space, particularly in crypto, even when you're thinking about broadly just financial markets. But yeah, so for us, really, we think of it in three legs. The first one is, you know, increased and further institutional adoption, particularly with the ETFs, you know, allowing increased access, particularly in the US, being a good example of that. The second leg is focused around supply constraints, and the Bitcoin halving is another great example of that, with the obviously reduced net issuance with the reduction in the block reward. And then the third piece is really just broad innovations. And one of the reasons, you know, we kind of think about that is particularly towards scaling with Ethereum. So there's a tying all these pieces together, you're starting to see quite a positive dynamic. You know, there's some strong price momentum right now. We're still kind of hovering right at that new all-time high, but really the institutional demand, a little bit of supply pressure, and, you know, continued innovation and development in the space is really giving us a, you know, at least a positive outlook for the short to medium term for the markets.
Cool. I like the way that kind of framing that. You've got the demand side of the equation, the supply side of the equation. Of course, the supply side for Bitcoin is totally different to Ether or other things. So still, there is a supply side. That's how you think about it in a nuanced way. Then that technology side. And when we did this podcast, I'm going to say a year ago, could have been a bit more than that. And I'd bring on the technical people and we'd unpack the networks and be like, what's changing? What's happening? And I'd say, well, good, people are building things because that's going to form the basis for whatever the next bull run is. Now, of course, people would have said I'm crazy at the time, but that kind of, once you start breaking it into the fundamental levels like you've done, demand, supply, technology, then you're actually able to sit there and look at the space with kind of, not with rose-colored glasses on, but in a structured, analytical way that's not overly emotional. And then, ultimately, you can understand how these markets and technology work. Let's go into each of the three pieces in a bit more depth. The first one there is the demand side. Now, you've correctly pointed out that one market and one segment of that market has essentially opened up due to regulatory decisions that were made, ETF approvals. There have been ETPs and ETFs available in other markets around the world, similar structure, they're not the same, for years, right? There's plenty of different ways to buy Bitcoins, or if you want, you can buy MicroStrategy or whatever. So what is it about that, in your opinion, with a few months now of retrospect, what is it about one big market like that going, making a decision around spot products when futures were around for years? The spot products have been available elsewhere. What is it about that that you think is the, the second, third order consequences from, what seems to be a relatively important regulatory decision?
Yeah, I think what it does is there's a few pieces here to unpack. I think one of them is, whether or not, so I'm sitting, we're both sitting here in London, so sitting, close to Europe or, historically on a part of Europe. The thing here is that I feel that even though products have been available here for quite some time, institutions have not necessarily adopted them because of the regulatory developments that are taking place with MiCA in Europe, with what's happening with the FCA. So that's kind of led to, they're progressing, I would still say relatively quickly and historically ahead of the US. But how that has evolved, there still is this natural tendency to look to the US, given, where they stand in the market. For I don't know if I would call it always leadership. I think that's some an opt and as an American, we tend to say these things. But more it's more of like a reference point and a benchmark. So I think it's using the US as a benchmark to know that, okay, now the US is actually finally a allowed for these to become widely available to retail investors and now institutions alike, particularly the investment advisory market, that, for example, manages my parents' retirement income or retirement assets, and they, have the 6 month or the annual meeting to talk about their asset allocations. And the pool of money that actually sits managed underneath these like IFAs is what they're called in the UK. In the US, it's the investment advisory market, and what they or the yeah the just the advisory market, and they really manage over 30 trillion in assets. So opening the door for them to actually begin to allocate is really a huge step. So this has led to, in Europe, a lot more conversations opening up from traditional asset managers. Asking about, okay, this is now becoming a serious asset class. It's obviously performed well, and that's great, but they're starting to understand the investment case. So when putting together these the investment case, around obviously the scarcity of the asset, this alternative monetary policy that can kind of give you a different type of exposure from the fiat currency world where you're looking at central banks. So they're starting to get familiarized with that and actually think about and starting to make allocations. So that really kickstarted Europe. And then in the US, it really opened the door for this 30 trillion to begin allocating. And so far, we've seen 10 billion in flows in the US, or maybe it's 11 or more now. But most of that has still come from retail, particularly because there has to be a wave of approvals by these advisory firms internally to begin to allocate, whether that be the Morgan Stanley offices, the all the other different advisory, I'll say umbrellas that are approving these type of products on the investment list, if you will. So we're really early stages. We've seen some really positive momentum in the asset flows and the ETFs. But for me, this is really I would say a really seminal point for actually growing up as an asset class for Bitcoin and digital assets more broadly.
Is $10 billion in flows in the first couple of months a good number? it's like measured against other ETF launches historically or against like the expected amount.
Yeah, exactly. So that's it's essentially, I don't know the explicit numbers comparatively, but it's essentially a record-breaking ETF success. So I know, you know, more people that are a bit more native to the crypto ecosystem might have been originally underwhelmed with the price action when it first was approved in January. We saw a temporary top during, you know, that week. But then obviously we've met new highs. So I think most people are quite satisfied and optimistic going forward. So for an ETF launch, having, you know, even 10 ETFs being launched all at once in competition, it's typically not the type of environment that you see in traditional, financial markets. And, you know, in terms of comparing across other historical ETF launches, it was a record-breaking launch and how quickly they raised assets.
Yeah. Okay, I understand there's a bit of displacement from existing products converting to ETFs at higher fees, or there was kind of people migrating from futures into the spot products. So like the net difference isn't too much. It's kind of interesting, you're right, that a lot of people said, well, when the approvals happen, Bitcoin's going to go up of 50%. And your point is, you can be patient, right? It's already hit its all-time highs again. Isn't that good enough for you?
Yeah, exactly. And we'll see more of that, I think. Yep.
Very nice. Let's talk about second PC of the supply side. We could talk about it in the context of Bitcoin, because that seems to be the one that's gathered a lot of mind share for reasons that you'll explain. That's different, though, to the supply side of Ethereum or Ether or Solana or one of the other major crypto tokens or cryptocurrencies. So let's just unpack a little bit why we think Bitcoin now. What is it about that supply curve that's interesting? It could be on its own or related to other so-called cryptocurrencies. And then we can think a little bit about the potential consequences, both historically and what you and I think is, you know, good ways to think about it.
Yeah, definitely. So I think, you, as you mentioned, you can't really not address the upcoming halving. I feel like, you know, there's a few other pieces we can look into, but the halving is definitely one of the key inflection points in the market. Obviously, we're kind of shifting to a new cycle, if you will. If we look historically, a lot of the strong performance took place around these halving events. And you can see that, and I'm sure that's been shared across many different, from many different sources. But that's one thing that is worth digging into and looking at, because if you are just to allocate during that time period, historically, it's always been quite positive. And then particularly with now how much attention is coming into the space with, you have now CNBC, you have Bloomberg, you have a lot of these traditional financial media outlets talking about it, getting, you know, my parents, aware of what this is and what this asset class is. So the fact that we're now entering into a stage where it's not just crypto natives, it's now going to be, I mean, I'm just going to say the word boomers, like there's going to be boomer adoption. And I think the fact that it's all across these traditional outlets is a huge step for that. And there's also more on-chain stuff as well. But the media aspect is a one that's notable.
Yeah. Now, I know that this stuff now appears on cable TV news and stuff. In two sentences, though, because we haven't defined the Bitcoin halvening. I assume folks know we've covered it on this show before. In two sentences, what is it?
So the first sentence is reduced block reward cut in half.
Okay.
Or phrase, if you will. Less new Bitcoins. Sorry, what?
Less new Bitcoins.
Yes, exactly. Less new Bitcoins coming online, entering into circulating supply. And continuing to do that roughly every 4 years until that new Bitcoin essentially becomes zero, which means you hit your maximum 21 supply, which gives it the scarcity that we talk about.
Yep. So if any of you listeners plan on being around in 2140, in 120 years or something, that's when the new ones will run out. So you've got to be patient. But How many of the bitcoins that will ever exist have already been mined?
19.7 million or so at this stage, maybe just below that. But once we hit the actual halving date, it'll be 19.7 million.
Yeah. So most of them have already been mined. The new ones that are created every 10 minutes, there'll be now half of that, and it'll happen for another 4 years till it's essentially programmed into the code to every 4 years cut X number in half again until it gets to almost zero, and then we subtract the balance in 100 years' time and it's zero. Right.
Yep.
Now, you've already said historically that when these events happen, were you around for the last one? Were you paying attention to the space closely enough?
Not extremely closely, but I was aware of it because I was very somewhat invested, but not enough to change my life, that's for sure.
Well, it's not an event with lots of balloons and the jukebox karaoke thing. What happens is the computer code kicks in. And this cannot be changed. If you were to try, it would be really difficult, right? And we also know, and I know you've been looking at this, you can go and look at the software, and you can see where it's written into the software to say, do this thing at this time and do it again on a schedule, right? So it's the transparency of the network that means that we can make these confidence statements, and our ability to read software that means that we can interpret the transparent information and say, no, that's what's going to happen. Because I know a lot of people say, how do you know that? Who's pressing the button somewhere to create the Bitcoins? I'm like, no, it's computer code. Well, how do you know that? I write software, it's open source software. There. What are you running into in the context of this kind of discussion? So I imagine you end up in the same ones.
Oh, yes. And it's to the point where I'm like, it almost drives me nuts. But so this is where, you know, you point to everybody go to github.com, go search the Bitcoin software, and then you can specifically go find the particular functions that are actually the block subsidy function that is issuing the new Bitcoin to the miners and defines how that works. You can see the code itself implementing the reduction over time. And there's also a second function sitting in the code base that you can look at that is essentially a validation function that says, it's a double check that they implement elsewhere that says never, ever more than 21 million. So everything is essentially handled in that first function, but there's even a second one to just triple check that there's no issue ever where there should ever exceed 21 million. So it is perfectly clear. You can all look at it on GitHub. So it's, so that's where that comes from.
So all this is nobody else asking us how we know this. we'll give you the links and you can prove it. What then becomes interesting, and we were talking about anticipation for the US ETFs and what does that mean? What do we expect in the markets? There's sad faces, Bitcoin's only hit its all-time high. When really let's think about it. This halving's gonna happen. We know historically what happens for halvings. But we also know most of the Bitcoins have been mined. We know the demand side of the equation is now stronger than it was. There was a bunch of hobbyists. We also can watch cable TV news and they will tell us that this is happening. So is this a situation where, and we don't have to be certain. Let's run through some scenarios. Isn't it one where history repeats itself and the demand side outstrips the supply side again, and people are willing to pay more for this scarce thing, and so it goes up. The next one is priced in already. It's already at all-time highs, and we're not going to move around much. The third is people sell the news, and then maybe there's some other thing out there that means either they just don't want Bitcoins anymore, or interest rates keep going up, so they have less money to slosh around on things, or there's maybe something else. Is that a good way in which to think about it? And if not, which ones, you don't have to say what you like one more than the other, but if people were trying to think about this in a probabilistic way almost, how do you think that they should look at it?
I think what you highlighted there is with the macro view at the end, with the interest rates, I think is a good one that is sometimes overlooked. So I think that's always you always want to have your macro umbrella kind of covering all of your views to make sure that that's framing things. So depending on how, we've seen that shift, and this isn't a macro podcast, so we won't talk about what the expectations are for future interest rates. And that's actually one of the beauties of Bitcoin, is that obviously we can kind of, we don't have to sit here and guess what's going to happen with this overall supply and the policy of things. So that speaks to that. So focusing particularly on, the few items you mentioned to start things off, I do think that this wave of increased attention, we typically see, there is naturally with the halvings increased attention historically that leads to new adoption. Now it's just amplified with all the media outlets that are covering it. We also now have institutions actually evaluating this from a very sophisticated portfolio construction standpoint and allocating. So if this is early days of institutional allocation, there's still significant money on the table that is not actually allocated. And there are clear benefits for small allocations in multi-asset portfolios due to the diversification benefits and the asymmetric upside return that we've seen historically, which is obviously not guaranteed, but there's also this alternative, it serves as an alternative asset and long-term store of value based off of the different characteristics that you and I have talked about offline, as well as I'm sure you've talked about in other, other circles and other different podcasts that we've been on. But so that the fact that it's evolving now to actually reach the institutional allocation point, that is huge. So there's a demand side focus there. On the supply side, this long-term store value narrative is evolving and can actually is starting to be verified by looking at some of the activity on chain with the supply that is essentially sitting in dormant wallets, if you will, and maybe dormant is not the right word, but wallets that are not actively, transacting. So you can analyze when certain Bitcoins were sent from one wallet to another. And if we just look at the last year, 70% of all Bitcoin sitting in wallets across the blockchain haven't moved in the last year. So there's only 30% that are actually being transacted day in and day out. So the fact that there is a significant amount that is being held in supply that is essentially not for sale, if you will, tells us that there's even more constraints on the supply side and even more, I would say, quantifiable evidence to say that this long-term store value narrative is continuing to prevail, which also leans into the institutional adoption case. So there's a lot of intermingled pieces here that would lead to increased adoption and reduced supply or supply constraints. Sorry, not reduced supply, but supply constraints, particularly with the halving, particularly with what's happening on chain and the lack of Bitcoin activity in these long-term within this long-term holding cohort.
Okay, that's cool.
Sorry, please go ahead.
I was going to say, I can imagine people sitting there now and thinking, yeah, but, which is kind of the fun part of the thought experiment, isn't it? One of them might say, well, doesn't the snake eat its tail? You don't get a market price if there's nothing on the market to buy or sell. So, that you could see that. Of course, the next argument would be, those dormant wallets, if those people decide the price is right and they just go out and start selling it, then you can have more supply on the market, right? So I could see already people saying that, and it's kind of interesting to think about. I don't have a definitive answer either, but at least you've just proposed a structured way in which to look at objective facts in the world and then try and deduce kind of heuristics or a framework for understanding this, which is more helpful than throwing your hands up and saying, I don't like it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's more helpful, which is good. It's for the listener's sake, and also it's just kind of somewhat for the curious. This is like catnip. Let's return to the last piece around the technology and how it's changing. And we can look at Ethereum specifically, though I've got a couple of good examples around Bitcoin also recently that are just kind of like indicative of how the space is evolving and changing, and how it's moving from a hobbyist thing 10 to 15 years ago through to something now where the largest asset managers have all got products, and CNBC is talking about the halving and all of these other kind of outward signs that we find that we've gotten somewhere to a place that it wasn't a decade ago. So what were the ones you have your eye on in particular in the last couple of weeks or months?
Yeah, I think so. The Den Kun upgrade is something that I mentioned at the start of the podcast as a good example of this and the scalability of Ethereum, because historically, all of these, I would say, alternative L1 smart contract platforms have emerged because of some of the challenges with Ethereum. Obviously, Ethereum being, the first smart contracts platform to actually reach scale and provide all of this interesting new activity that is Web3, these new economies that are being built directly on the blockchain through applications. And one of the challenges is the actual costs of transacting on Ethereum, as well as the actual transaction speed for various use cases that are out there. So with the Ethereum Den Kun upgrade, essentially it made transactions faster and cheaper for layer twos that are essentially bundling transactions and then settling them on the Ethereum base layer. So with that, it really is a solution to scale Ethereum, which actually takes away or has the potential to take away from a lot of these alternative L1s that are out there, because obviously that was one of the key reasons that they were formed in the original went upon their inception.
All right. So the Ethereum network continues to change, evolves over time. It is a gradual process. Nothing broke, which is always
Exactly.
interesting. Nothing broke, because that's the big risk if you're doing upgrades to networks like that or pieces of the network. So they've gotten that right. They've been doing that for a few years now. That code does change over time quite a bit, unlike Bitcoin. So it becomes a different beast over time. But it's alleviating one of these constraints to adoption of a network for hopefully useful economic activity, which certainly another stablecoin piece can be useful. There's another last one that I've got an eye on, or at least an example of something that makes the technology easier to use but doesn't play around with the base layer of the technology. So it does involve changing Bitcoin's code. It wouldn't necessarily require one to change the Ethereum code. It's just a way in which to make it easier to use this technology. Jack Dorsey, the guy who came up with Twitter, his company is called Block, and they've released, it is a Bitcoin, I guess you could call it wallet, but it's more of like a signing device. Comes to like it's a little hexagonal thing, and it takes, I'm going to say, 5 minutes to set this thing up with a cell phone. It shards the keys in three different places. So if any one of them disappear, get lost, destroyed, you can recover it, right? Nobody can use, you need two out of three shards, right? So they can store it in the cloud, but they can't use it. They need your. So I've set this thing up in 5 minutes. This is completely different to 10 years ago, juggling seed phrases and, having to put it in copies and in a safe box and hope my computer doesn't get stolen or. How do I sign the transaction so I can send my bitcoins into Bitcoin? All of that stuff has gone away with devices like that. And I would just point at it as one example of where the kind of consumer friendliness of this stuff, because they've got good designers in now, good UI people and UX people in, who really understand how, to make this convenience accessible and almost a delight to use. It's a little bit like what Steve Jobs and Apple did with iPhones. Similar design thinking and principles. While the network layers are interesting, and I know you track it, just use one example, I'm also finding it kind of like the, you say the consumer electronics, you could say the institutional investor one. I mean, isn't the equivalent of this thing for retail, isn't this an ETF?
Yeah, exactly. Great. That's a great analogy right there.
On the back end, the ETFs use sharded keys in an institutional grade setup, right? You've got a different one here, but if you make it more convenient to use, it could increase demand for it over time. You haven't had to go and fiddle with any of the lower layer stuff. So they're just different things, but that at least caught my eye and came to mind as you were explaining a few of your topics today from your Outlook. Where can people find the Outlook and where can they find you on the interwebs?
So you can find me on LinkedIn is the best place. You'll find our posts and our blogs shared there, as well as on the website, so wisdomtree.eu. Find plenty of resources on digital assets there. So, you know, look me up, add me, or, you know, feel free to reach out to digitalassets@wisdomtree.com for any questions. But yeah, happy to connect.
Yep. Check out the Outlook. Blake's publishing stuff all the time. If you have enjoyed today's discussion, you'll enjoy his periodic and relatively frequent updates as well on the Wisdom Tree website. In the meantime, Blake, thanks for joining me. I'll say I will probably see you in a few more weeks, and we can talk harvesting and see if like the way we've thought about it makes any sense whatsoever. So if you'll join me again, I think it'd be a really great one.
Oh, excellent. Would be happy to. Thanks for having me.
All right.
Well, there you have it, folks. Blake Hyman, Senior Associate of WisdomTree's Quantitative Research Team. There's your outlook for the next 6 months. Stay tuned. It's never dull in this space, digital assets. And we'll see what lays ahead of us in the future. People in the US, WisdomTreePrime.com. Check it out in the app stores. Come and find me. I'm on the Bird app. I'm there. Too much. We can talk about obscure books. We can talk about interesting historical things. We can talk about digital assets if you want as well at Benjamin Dean on the Bird app. There we go. Come back next time. Always love having you here. It's always a pleasure. I hope you have an excellent, excellent day. Ciao.